Hello, and welcome to this episode of Akram Life Hacks. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Moody, a practicing rural generalist in Queensland. Akram acknowledges the Australian Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people as the first inhabitants of the nation. We respect the traditional owners of lands across Australia in which our members and staff work and live, and pay respect to their elders past, present and future. Today, I'm joining you from Yagara and Turrbal country. Hello, dear listeners. Today, we're going to hear two unique voices representing the people we are serving as rural generalists, our rural and remote health consumers. Deborah Robbins is a member of the Canton Hinterland Hospital and Health Service Community Consultation Committee in Queensland and an advocate for patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Carolyn is currently a Darling Downs Hospital and Health Service health consumer. She receives primary care from a Toowoomba-based general practice. Previously, Carolyn was employed by Queensland Health to initially help set up the inaugural Health Consumers Queensland and its Ministerial Consumer Advisory Committee. Since Health Consumers Queensland moved into the not-for-profit sector, Carolyn has been a member of its consumer network, leading to her appointment as the consumer representative on the Queensland Rural and Remote Clinical Network Steering Committee. Both are members of the Consumers Health Forum of Australia Rural and Remote Special Interest Group and bring extensive experience advocating on behalf of rural patients. Welcome to the podcast, Deb and Carolyn. Really be interested to hear about an interaction that each of you have had with a rural doctor that you found therapeutic or especially pleasant. And what was it about that interaction that you think made you feel that way? So, Carolyn, we might start with you.
Thanks, Emily. One that I can think about started out as a negative interaction with another rural doctor in the same practice. I had been experiencing a lot of pain and had developed a golf ball size lump on my back. So I went to the first doctor and asked him to have a look at it. Very cursorily, he said to me, just a condition of aging. But then I was like 55 or something. I left it a few weeks, and with the encouragement of some of my social work colleagues at the Ipswich Hospital, I went back to the practice but demanded to see another doctor. And the doctor I saw was actually an overseas trained doctor. He came from Southeast Asia, and he was so open to listening to my concerns. He didn't just disregard what I had to say. He gave me a thorough examination. He ordered tests and everything and didn't say too much to me until the tests came back. And unfortunately, when the test came back, it wasn't a very good result. It was actually quite a life-threatening result. But this doctor talked me through it. He helped me. He made a referral to, at the time, the Ipswich Hospital, which was then my closest regional hospital. And from there, he worked with my social work supervisor to expedite that referral through the system right through to the feeder hospital at the Princess Alexandra Hospital, where I happened to run into one of my registrar colleagues I'd worked with at the hospital. So this rural doctor, who was not originally from Australia, took my needs and interests very seriously, listened to me, and while the outcome, of course, is never wonderful, I'm still here the first time, or the third time round, actually, to tell the tale.
Wow. It sounds like that rural doctor really advocated for you.
Yes.
And not only listened to you and sounds like did a thorough examination and all the appropriate clinical steps, but was then able to talk you through a life-threatening result. So a really difficult and distressing consultation by the sounds of it.
Yes, distressing not only for myself, but my family too.
Yeah. Yeah, well, no, thank you. I think there's some really great points out of that reflection that we can all learn from. So thank you for sharing that, Carolyn. And Deb, would you be comfortable sharing about a pleasant interaction that you've had?
I tend to remember the negative things. but I guess, you know, you develop a long-term relationship with your GP and you really feel it when they're not there, because the locum or the doctor you really need to see doesn't have that same understanding of your condition and your home circumstances. So I can remember, you know, thinking many times, oh, if only Draghi was here, I wouldn't have needed that chest x-ray. Or I know I had a lump on my breast and my GP wasn't around and I knew it was a cyst. I'd had it for many years, but it was getting very necrotic and painful and enlarged. And so the doctors that I saw before, while in his absence, sort of wanted, you know, imaging done and so forth, and thought it might have been something more nefarious. And it was a relief to me. And then the imaging tests would come back inconclusive. So I kind of, you know, waited out. And at my next visit to that GP, who's very skilled with minor surgery, actually, he listened to me and believed me and said, I still have to send this away if I excise it for you, Deb. You know that, don't you? And I said, yeah, no, that's fine. But, he removed it, no trouble. And, of course, it wasn't anything else but a very necrotic cyst that had gone bad. You know, and I can remember my girlfriend saying, Deb, only you could get a breast lump removed in someone's surgery. It wasn't about that at all. It was about being taken seriously and believed. And I remember the feeling of, oh, at last, someone's listening to me. And, you tend to remember that. And I think a similar thing happened with needing a medical certificate extended. And your GP isn't there and you go to someone else and you're quite anxious that you won't be able to work because of a side effect you've still got. And, having to go to work because they don't understand you're a caregiver at home of a paralyzed 90-kilogram person and you're, you need a little bit more time off to get well. And so that was quite disappointing. But in your heart of hearts, you know, well, your regular doctor would know all that patient journey context more thoroughly and look after you, I guess, or meet you halfway kind of thing.
Thanks, Deb. Well, you said you tend to remember the negative more, which I think is just human nature, isn't it? But have you got a reflection about an experience you've had with where you wish you'd been treated differently? And this is with an attitude of learning for myself and for the doctors listening.
The funniest one was probably 40 years ago when my husband let the GP do a vasectomy in his surgery, his demountable surgery in Newton. And I couldn't believe that he agreed to it because the doctor was like, you know, you hear those old stories about dentists between the textbook and my husband and the kidney dish. And he really suffered. He suffered for a couple of weeks after. Terrible, swelling and discomfort and pain. And, he talked to other fellows afterwards, after the fact. He said, oh, you know, I didn't experience anything. I went to the urologist and rode my motorbike home afterwards. So I guess looking back, that's probably the funniest one.
Not for him.
not for him at the time. You know, at the time, you had to feel sorry for him. But, that's probably the funniest one. And I guess with more recently with my husband and returning, being airlifted back to the country after, doctors in the city not appreciating the fact that he couldn't heal because he couldn't sleep and he wasn't given any kind of consideration, being very, very sick on the heart transplant list. He wasn't being given a quieter place to sleep. There was a policy where the nursing sisters chose the smaller rooms for patients based on gender. And, you know, I'd say to the doctor, why can't he even stand up and push his IV stand like yesterday? And they'd say, oh, he's so very tired, he's not sleeping. And I'd say, well, what can you do about that? And they'd say, nothing. And so it was really nice when my husband landed back here in the region to have his cardiologist take one look at him and say, you look terrible. You need sleep. I will give you rest. And it was just so lovely to have that. Once again, you know, someone show a lot more compassion. And, you know, a couple of days, you know, in a quieter ward, in a quieter room, and, you know, he picked up again. So I really appreciate that concern for your holistic health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, sleep is just key to our health and happiness, isn't it? That's really great that such a basic need was recognised and met. Carolyn, have you got a story for us?
My story probably revolves around privacy legislation. My late first husband was critically ill for quite some time, but unfortunately, because his mental health state sort of mirrored the physical, that he found it difficult to allow me to find out what was happening. And as his carer at the time, like I'd take him to appointments, I'd take him to the hospital outpatients and everything, but I was never allowed to get the full picture. Even though I asked repeatedly, saying, look, I am the carer, this is the man, I monitor his medication, I organise his community services, et cetera, et cetera. And it was only when his health deteriorated dramatically, it was actually a Melbourne Cup day and I'd had a day off for once, I actually rang the surgery and I demanded that not only will I bring my husband in, because he was critically unwell, I thought, but that I be present at that interview with the doctor, with the GP. When we got there and we finally got into the consulting room, the GP said to me, what's taken you so long? I said, well, A, privacy considerations, my husband, and also the fact that perhaps you weren't understanding that there are other people in the scenario that needed to be considered to give my late husband the holistic care, as Deborah said, that he required. And from there, you know, it was a hard journey getting him into hospital respite, then finally into residential respite, where he passed away 12 months after that. But when the door was finally opened by the professionals, things started to move, and he got a degree of care that I couldn't give him, bearing in mind I had two others that I was trying to care for and work full time at the same time to keep the wolf from the door. So always sort of think about the implications when you say, oh, that's confidential information, I can't breach the Privacy Act, because it does not only have impact on your patient but their community of interest, and particularly their carer, who is usually co-resident.
When you look back on that time, which sounds really difficult, was that consultation where you were able to attend a real turning point in that journey?
Yes, the turning point, and the fact that the doctor sort of had expected me to come and made that statement about what took you so long, that, you know, certainly sometimes I think in the limited time our GPs have with their patients, you can't handle everything, and sometimes you're only addressing the patient with the problem here and now rather than looking, as I say, that social and economic determinants of health and what helps that person live a quality life. And, yes, it certainly opened the door and provided myself and my family with some surety.
Well, speaking of general practice consultations, both of you have experienced plenty. And when you walk into that room, what is it that doctors do as part of a consultation that makes you feel comfortable?
It's Carol and Emily. For me, it's going into that room, being welcomed, asked, take a seat, but then the doctor leaning forward and saying, I know what you've booked in for. Tell me about the other things that are happening in your life, because that person is aware that there's a whole lot of other interpersonal things happening, and taking the time to listen to that. And can I say, just recently I had an experience. I finally got hold of my doctor of choice at the GP practice, and I mistakenly only booked a regular appointment. When I walked in the room, she said, Carolyn, I've taken the liberty of booking a long appointment for you because there's a lot of things I want to catch up with you. And it ended up being a 50-minute appointment. But she found out what she needed to progress her care, because before that there'd been a number of locums and other GPs in the practice that had done some of the basic work while she was away and things. So I found that so welcoming. And she now is much more au fait with what's going on my life, health-wise, and also with the personal stuff.
Oh, that's wonderful. Taking the liberty of booking you a long appointment. That's very generous. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. And what about you, Deb?
Much the same. I have to agree with Carolyn. Probably not to that same extent, but to just have them, you know, prompt you to say, you know, how are you? What's going on with you? And then have a bit of small talk, and then say, well, what have you come to talk to me about today? So I guess that little bit of a greeting is always welcome. I've never experienced the intense interest that Carolyn described. But, I tend to take the hint and talk about what's been extremely difficult lately or something good that's happened. Usually it's something interesting about health that's happened to another family member that I tell them about. But I suppose that signals I'm telling them something I find stressful at the moment. And then they can, you know, use that in the context of what is the actual reason I've come to see them, and then I can imagine they might factor that in with if I'm stressed about something else at the same time. So yeah, much the same.
I see what you're saying. And Deborah, what about when you attend a consult with your son? So there's two of you in the room with a doctor or a GP. What is it about the way that the GP talks to you and your son that can make both of you feel comfortable?
Well, I did have a lot of years of that. I can remember taking my son to an orthopedic appointment, probably the only time he was visibly upset, and we're discussing a procedure, and the doctor mimicked the way he walked. He found that very humiliating and upsetting. So I wouldn't recommend doing that. But generally over the years, you know, you just know when a doctor, even a neurologist who's supposed to be an expert in that field, knows nothing about your disease, because the first thing he or she will do is reach out and try and shake my son's hand. And that can be very embarrassing, because it might be 5, 10, he's got an advanced condition, and 5, 10 years since he's been able to lift his arm from his armrest or his lap. And, you know, there's that awkward moment of, you know, he thinks I'm being rude. He doesn't know that I can't lift my hand up. And that happened quite a few times. The other side of the coin is true as well. Many times the doctor would be talking to me as if he wasn't in the room, because he's got a disability, and you know, associating some kind of mental deficit with his severe physical disability. So the eye contact is all with me rather than him. And I mean, in the neuromuscular clinics, of course, they switched on to this, and so they'll have a part of the consultation where the parents are asked to leave the room, so that then the child or the teen needs to answer for themselves, or who can ask an intimate question they don't want mum and dad to know about. And in that way, the specialist is preparing them to take more responsibility and mindfulness and charge of their own health. Nowadays, his wife, he married about 6 years ago and moved out, and he's independent. So nowadays his wife attends appointments with him. Although when I'm busy and when she's busy, he might ask me to go with him. And sometimes he'll just have a support worker with him. I guess when both of them are feeling not confident or want extra input, they'll ask, would I like to go to an appointment? And I'll say yes. But if I don't think I can be of value, of course, I decline. And there are other times where they might tell me about the appointment afterwards. And that's fine too, because that's telling me that they've got confidence, confidence to remember everything that needs to be asked and so on.
Thanks, Deb. That's really helpful for us to hear. And I'm pleased that your son continues to receive really good support and, you know, has gone off and left home and gotten married and is thriving in his own life. That's really pleasing. So I just want to move on a little bit now to, again, back to the rural towns that you've lived in, and both of you have lived in several rural towns around Queensland, and you've met multiple doctors, and I'm sure that you've both been able to meet with doctors outside of the consultation room just as part of the rural community, especially with how involved you've both been in community groups. So I wondered if you had any tips for doctors who are moving out to a rural town for the first time, what some advice you might have for them on how they could integrate with their rural community in order to feel supported themselves and to be able to thrive.
I watch my children, my grandchildren live in small communities in the Gulf, and they live and work in Western Queensland. And even, when they're in larger centres, I think they appreciate the medical staff, the doctors and nurses that get down and dirty with them, go out to the local wine by the sea ball or the events and socialise with them. I think they really appreciate that. And I can remember when I was young too. Doctors used to be in Rotary with my husband, and you'd see them and their families at the Christmas raffles at the ambulance centre, and it was good. I can understand that rapport is great for a lot of people. But me being a very probably unsociable person, I actually prefer the Doc Martin types. I prefer the effusive familiarity, the effusive bedside manner. I'm not mistrustful of it, and I appreciate it at one level, but I think I'd much rather have compassion shown to me by a doctor that is very responsive, that'll be pick up a phone while you're in there and so get to the bottom of why there's no discharge summary yet, who will answer a phone call or an email, but maybe after rounds or after clinic, they might ring you on their way home to answer an important question. Someone like a bulldog who wants to get to the bottom of the problem, and not just brush it aside because they can't find a quick fix answer. So, I prefer responsiveness and the skills of someone and the way they demonstrate care and compassion through being expert and expert and responsive. But yeah, I can see how a lot of people want that social rapport with doctors, and there have been times in my life when I think it's great to have that kind of relationship with a doctor.
I think I have a little bit of a different viewpoint, sort of having had family members in various rural and remote communities, that if the new doctor in town has come to work in the practice or the hospital, doesn't start to get involved in his community, people are going to have a wariness about him. Most doctors, either the younger doctors who are don't have an attachment or those who come with young families and things, they have so many opportunities to become involved, like through the school, through, as Deborah mentioned, some of the local community groups like Lions, Toastmasters, for instance, or others. And it's about showing that they're human and that after the surgery doors close for the day or the week or whatever, that they become Mr. A and that they are willing to become involved to some extent with their local community. And to me, that builds a humanity into them to show that they're just like us. They have an area of expertise in certain things, but they also appreciate that social connectedness. And I think it's also good for if they do have families and young children, that the families are able to be involved in community events and things and not distance from it. And it leads to, I believe, that social connectedness and the reduction in loneliness, and certainly helps them become a part of the social fabric of that community.
Thanks, Carolyn. I completely agree. That's certainly been my experience living in rural communities too. I like what Deb said, getting down and dirty with the opportunities and events that you have to integrate into the rural community. All right. Well, you're both so active as consumer representatives, as we've heard a lot about, especially at the beginning of our conversation. And you're both members of the Consumers Health Forum of Australia. So I appreciate you must both have an understanding of the rural landscape, not just in Queensland, but also across our whole country. I'd be very interested to hear from you both about what you think the main concerns are for rural consumers in Australia at the moment. Big question.
It's a real privilege to be in a group where you get lots of perspectives, especially from people living really remotely. I can remember in the bushfires learning so much because, you know, people, other consumers were down there and affected, and they needed to be consulted by the health authorities and things because they would have circumstances where water would be trucked in and yet no one could tell them where that water came from and whether it was safe to drink. And, you know, you think, wow, you know, you've got to be there on the ground and really live it and experience it, you know, to have those kinds of concerns about health and your questions. So, yeah, it's been a real privilege to be able to get all those different countrywide perspectives from other consumers. But I guess my concerns sort of mirror the Australian Rural Institute, that you know, we have a big country, the super cities are getting too big, the climate change, the lack of space, the lack of quality of life mentally, hard to find a job, so economic hardship. And then we have this beautiful wide country with all these wonderful big rural towns and smaller rural towns. And if the medical staff were there, if the infrastructure were there, we could spread out and we could all enjoy a better quality of life. And in some ways, the telehealth and the technology is addressing that, but it can never fully replace having real live medical professionals and nurses and doctors and therapists, you know, close by. And that would attract the people, not for just for health reasons, because we all die one day. It's inevitable. But for the future of our country, to really use the space well and resources well and look after the planet and quality of life of my grandchildren and their children. I think it's so important for that reason. And I mean, you look at the McGrath Foundation and the breast nurses. I saw at the end of the Pink Day there, the announcement made, they'd made so much money that a qualified breast cancer nurse would be within 75 kilometres of every patient in Australia because of the number of virtual seats they sold on the Pink Day of the cricket. And I thought, well, gee, that's what we should have. We should have a physio, we should have a doctor, you know, we should have other medical specialists, you know, scattered all around the country. And then the people living in these super cities would think about other things and they'd be able to move and live rurally. I guess that's my overview.
Yeah, so access to care from health professionals on the ground in rural communities.
Indeed, and I mean, the same goes for schooling, same goes for everything else, transport, schooling, every other domain. I mean, we need those things more evenly spread across the country.
Thanks, Deb. What about you, Carolyn?
I reflect Deb's views about being an absolute privilege to be a health consumer on any government or not-for-profit organisations, that we're given that unique gift to actually put the viewpoint of so many others who don't have a voice. But in relation to my concerns, I guess being a rural producer, somewhat small, but producing food for the table for my fellow Australians, the big thing that I'm really worried about, and it comes from personal lived family experience, is the mental health of our rural and remote farmers and associated industries. My older sister was on a rural property quite away from town in the central Burnett region of Queensland. Unfortunately, she overdosed, and by the time an aerial ambulance could be there, she passed away on her way to Mundaberg. She's just one case, I believe, in what happens to so many of our rural and remote farmers when times are tough, when there's X number of years of drought, then we have the flooding rains, then we have the bushfires. And to me, it's more about that social isolation. Yes, telehealth and other forms of Zoom and that are probably helping to alleviate that, but loneliness, a loneliness of a woman whose husband might be working out in the property for 8, 10, 12 hours. She's maybe stuck in the house on her own or with children. That leads to a whole lot of issues, let alone all the farm labour shortages. So I think when we're looking in terms of rural and remote people who are in farm agricultural type industries and that, we have to look at the impact on their mental health, the propensity for suicide, and we know that's very high. But we also have to look at another thing that I've recently become aware of, alcohol dependence. So many of our people in rural and remote communities depend on alcohol because their only avenues for socialisation, apart from schools and maybe, are sporting clubs and pubs. So you go and you have a drink or two and you socialise, and before they know it, there's a massive dependence on that, leading to all sorts of health issues. And, of course, my big one too, and that's very current here in Queensland at the moment, is the lack of maternity services for our young mums or to-be mums on those rural properties that are having to basically plan ahead to say, well, I'm going to leave the property 3 weeks, 4 weeks before and relocate down to Brisbane, Townsville, Cairns or whatever to give birth to their upcoming bump. And that also leads to a whole lot of relationship issues. But once again, it leads to a cost that sometimes is too hard to bear, and it can build relationships. And also the young mum, sometimes because of all that isolation from family and friends, finds it difficult to bond with bubs. So I think it's about how we look at providing the services, as Deb said, as to close to home as possible, consistent with the cultural values and norms and environment that they've come from.
Wow, so much there, Carolyn. Loneliness is, it's a killer really, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and the mental health of farmers, thank you for raising that, and lack of maternity services, I believe is a problem across the country, not just Queensland at the moment, but it's very real. So thank you for raising that too and for bringing that to our the forefront of our minds. So before we finish up, I know you're both very involved with the advocacy groups that you're connected with. Are there any that you want to talk about briefly right now to increase awareness of those amongst our rural doctors?
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And isn't it an irony that, getting back to nature and fresh air and all that is better for your mental health. But, you know, if you're living out, in rural areas, all the difficulty is also stressful. So, I mean, yeah, it's quite an irony, isn't it? And if we just had equity of access for all Australians, I think we'd be able to, we'd all have a better future, I think.
Probably need to talk about with that last question was about Save Our Sons, or if there's any other groups you're connected with that you think it would be beneficial for rural doctors to be aware of.
Yes, it is the pig body in Australia. I mean, I founded another pig body years before, which disbanded, but this is the current one. And I guess very small charitable organisations have a big brief to advocate, without a lot of government support and relying on donations and so on for people around the country. I think a big one is the things we do well, like intensivists and ICU do well, but what about the community care that isn't there that makes you wind up there? And it's the same with neuromuscular clinics for children. They've done such a great job, but they haven't really continued that care into adulthood. So complex needs adults that, have a lot of comorbidities are now out there with very few really good coordinated care clinics for adults around the country. So you're not getting that, world standard of care for adults. They're having to find, it's not official. So their pulmonologist or their respiratory team might be there triaging and bringing in general physicians for surgeries and cardiologists and so on. But we don't have that, lifelong good coordinated care. And of course, with regards health and involvement in partnerships for consumers, you can be in a group and just be informed, and you don't get any feedback about where your advice goes. And then you can be in a group like I know as a consumer consultant for Genomics Queensland, we are actually co-creating and co-doing tasks and co-authoring the literacy projects and the things that you're doing. So I think the full partnership with patients applies to rare disease too. And I can recall a lot of times bringing experts here, not being so insular, learning from overseas experts and world standards. And I can recall Shane Warne gave us a big grant once, and we bought the Royal Melbourne Children's and Westmead their first cough assist machines. And now these are life-saving for secretion clearance for anyone with Duchenne. That was like 20 years ago. And the same thing happened with non-invasive ventilation. Boys and men with Duchenne stayed in their bedroom on their BiPAP machine. There was no way to leave their rooms because they couldn't breathe otherwise. And, you know, there were hospitals in Victoria, for instance, that would give patients a second BiPAP to mount on a tray so that they could leave their homes. But, you know, just by seed funding machines, working with the clinicians, and so they could collect local evidence, you know, the government then came on board and said, right, well, after so many hours of needing, you know, ventilation, you can be given a portable ventilator, and so you can breathe away from your home and get out in the community again. So I think charities and small organizations where you can raise awareness and bring experts here and work in with clinicians and together bring some of these innovations about, I really think that that's been successful, and I think we need more of it. And I think even before the pandemic, we started to think we knew everything and we didn't need to network with others. And I think Carolyn mentioned earlier that the new recruits coming into the rural areas have fresh ideas and so on. And I think that's really wonderful. They have other experiences and fresh ideas, and everybody can learn from each other.
Carolyn, what about you? So your final chance to talk to any groups or organisations that you want to draw awareness to.
Thanks, Emily. I think most of us are very aware of the big groups like Lifeline, Beyond Blue, St Vinny's, and all those that provide wonderful services across the community, either online, or by phone, or in person. But I think for our doctors who may be listening today, if you are thinking about going into a rural community to work, is to get to know the local groups who are doing such wonderful work to support their fellow community members. And that's not only just Rotary, Lions, and many other organisations, but one organisation that I particularly support was started up by a lady who used to go around to farmers around Australia selling agricultural equipment. She noticed that every time she went to a farm or a community, there was one farmer missing. That farmer had taken their life, and it became a consistent pattern. So that drove her to start up a group called Are You Bogged, Mate? And I've listened to Mary speak about that in our local community and other areas. She's got a fantastic website, and it's about health consumers, community members, helping each other to recognise that someone's doing it tough. They are bogged. They can't see the wood for the trees. And I would support that. And another one, because I'm a rural farmer, is Drought Angels. Drought Angels is there, you know, not only with gifts of bales of hay, but money. I've even received a cash card for IGA out of the blue from them because they knew we were doing it tough. Another one I would suggest is Rural Aid. There are so many of these organisations, and a lot of them are now spread throughout Australia, that are doing great work, but they probably don't get the kudos that the big ones like Lifeline and Beyond Blue and that get, and even the McGrath Pink Day, you know, fantastic as it is. There are grassroots groups that are doing great work, and I'd encourage any person who's thinking about heading to the bush to start practice or to actually get to know what is available in their local community or what they can tap into to make life better for their fellow citizens.
Fantastic, Carolyn. We'll have to make sure we put links to those charities in the link to this podcast and then everybody can access them. All right. Well, thank you so much, Carolyn and Deborah, for joining me today on the Life Hacks podcast. I've learned so much speaking with both of you, and I thank you so much for your honesty and your courage in speaking about your journeys as rural health consumers. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Emily, for the opportunity.
Thank you, Emily.